So Jorge Calero, who's the guy that's heading the Chincana project, which is the team that I was out there in Cusco seeing, who are doing all these excavations at Sacsayhuaman. They've done an update recently. There was a press conference recently where they've been continuing the GPR scans and the excavations, and they're finding connecting points. I can't remember exactly where they were saying that these places were intersecting, but it was with a church down in the Cusco Valley region and then into the actual city itself, corresponding with Sacsayhuaman and areas in Sacsayhuaman that were starting to show like more advanced stonework than when I was there. Because when I went down there, even though it's kind of simple, it's still really weird. You're going all the way down into the like deep parts of the earth, and then there's just these three or four blocks that are precision cut coming out of the soil. So that was what I saw, but that's been, continued upon, and they found even more. And from what I remember on the article, yeah, there's like corresponding chambers that they've now found that are connecting to others. So it's really starting to confirm the Andean legends that were out there in the first place, you know?
Are they inferring the direction, or have they like literally traced a
Let me get
connecting
the
path?
Joe. It was actually Joe who sent me the link to it. He was like, "Have you seen this?" One second.
Because that just fascinates me. If they were able to like literally physically, connect the paths, that's mind blowing. I mean, it's mind blowing either way. If they're able to infer the direction of one end of the path, would
Here we
meet
go.
the other end.
One
The other
second.
thing is that once you do that and you realize that it's not just fables and stories, that means that all the other stuff could be true as well, right?
Yeah, so it says, it says the existence of a tunnel network under the ancient Peruvian city of Cusco has been rumored for centuries, at times stretching more than a mile. The labyrinth connected to the Temple of the Sun to key points such as a fortress. Incan buildings made use of what's known as the cut and cover method of crafting tunnels. Now, that these guys are obviously doing it from the perspective of it being Inca. I don't actually think it's Inca. But
No.
it says the Incan Temple of the Sun in Cusco has long been a visual and cultural jewel of the ancient empire, but there's even more to admire below ground. Recently, archaeologists confirmed a long-held rumor, the existence of a labyrinth of underground tunnels extending out from the temple, sometimes over a mile in length, first hinted at in historical texts that date as far back as the 16th century. Researchers have wondered if this labyrinth, known as the Chincana, was real. Turns out it is. Archaeologists Jorge Calero, who was the guy that I met, announced the findings at a press conference and said the research team found a main branch connecting the temple to the fortress at Sacsayhuaman just over 1 mile away. The system is made up of three smaller branches, one near the church of San Cristobal, another to an area near the fortress, and a third to an area known as Calispaquio. Probably pronouncing that wrong, but yeah, so that's what they've been discovered. That's an incredible development from when I was out there.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
Like
dude.
the elevation drop must be huge.
It just seems that there's so much subterranean infrastructure in these really interesting parts of the world, like Egypt and Peru, Turkey, all these areas where you find incredible similarities in these megalithic structures. You also find evidence of vast subterranean infrastructure. And I think that's telling a story that we're not being, fully told right now.
It's interesting. I don't know anything about this at all, but
don't tell Dibbles.
Don't tell the dibbler will get to you.
That was just saying something about how it was originally, or the path to where that labyrinth is was a Jesuit discovery back in the 16th century, right?
Let me bring it back up
Or
again.
so.
The path to finding the ancient labyrinth started with Jesuit texts from the 16th century. Yeah, an anonymous Spanish
Nice.
Jesuit individual wrote about a tunnel in 1594 that connected the bishop's housing to the Cusco Cathedral, alluding to the fact that the tunnel originated at the Temple of the Sun. A later document from chronicler Anello de Olivia also discussed multiple underground passages in the city. Yeah, man, the Jesuits getting involved, of course, right? No surprises there. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that, John Luke?
Yeah, I think he does. I think I do as well.
I'll let John Mazurowski go with that.
Oh. Well, if it's like anything else in history, I'm sure the Jesuits figured it out, dug into it, dug out what they wanted to dig out, told everybody to be quiet about it, paid a bunch of money, took what they needed, and bounced. So when they go in there's going to be a bunch of junk and clay pots and just bullshit that's laying around and whatever else, and maybe some cues of modern excavation, modern excavation. So I don't know what year that was. What year did they say that the Jesuits was that?
16th century.
Yeah, so that shit's gone. That's in the it's in the basement of the Vatican already. Whatever you're going to find that was of any importance is already in the basement. Yeah.
Do you think the Jesuits were pulling the strings of the original conquistador kind of expansion into Peru?
No, but I'm pretty sure they had guys that were part of it that were in there. The Vatican said it's the biggest spy network in the world, and they paid. So when anybody came up with anything, they're like, "Hey, that's ours. Give us the money." And those dudes were there, man. Anybody, even if even Muslims and other religions were still handing shit over to the Vatican, or representatives of the Vatican. And hell, they probably didn't even know they're part of the Vatican. They were just handing over anything that had any significance that they wanted from cash.
Taking anything good.
Mm-hmm.
There's also decided where they can put stuff in there too to mislead because that's happened before. Jesuits have been connected to, connected to placing certain artifacts into archaeological digs to confuse people.
The biggest one was the guy that got caught with the skull, wasn't it?
It was the guy who came up with the Omega Point theory, which is a big thing with Diana Pasulka. Teilhard de Chardin. And he's the guy that basically is a Jesuit. He came up with the concept that we're all heading towards some kind of massive planetary-wide Christ consciousness. Yeah. So, and that the Christ or the Christos is essentially us reaching a level of consciousness where we all become kind of one hive mind, I guess. I mean, somebody probably sound wrong on that, but that's kind of the vibe of it. But anyway, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was in England in his youth, in his 20s, and is connected. Lots of people think he's the guy that put the Piltdown Man hoax in place. And the Piltdown Man hoax was when, for a little while in history, they found a skull in an archaeological dig in the UK.
That's
what was kind of like the missing link, right? And what this was like a push forward of humanism and to take away the idea of any kind of, it's basically to push forward the idea of evolution, right? Scientism. But it turned out that the skull that was in there that suddenly for a small period of time was accepted as being part of our historical reality was in fact a jawbone from one type of ape and a skull from another, yeah? And they've been carefully placed there. And his name comes up as one of the prime suspects. Because I was reading about Teilhard de Chardin a while back, and it was funny when I started seeing it coming up as a publicly spoken about thing. So it was Danny Sheehan. His institution's called the Christos Institute, or it was.
He's a Jesuit, right? He's in the Jesuit order, yeah.
Oh yeah, he's the lawyer for the United States at one point for the entire Jesuit order of the United States of America.
Not just a Jesuit, quite a powerful one.
Like running the interference for all of the Jesuits in the U.S.
Didn't he represent Lou Elizondo for a short minute?
Yeah, he represented everybody. Stephen Greer, Lou Elizondo.
Yeah, he's the UFO lawyer, right?
He hangs out with RFK Jr. now. Like you said, they think he spent some of Christmas with him.
Was a photo, wasn't there, of them all together at Christmas time, he's rubbing shoulders with some powerful people.
He represents them enough to gather information and then leave them as clients.
That's part of the process, right?
Who's he reporting to?
I don't know, allegedly.
It is interesting though, because obviously, because he had an entire institute that was set up around the teachings of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And then Pasulka then talks about him quite a lot in her last book, talking about that concept of the Omega Point. So it's become part of ufology. And obviously, I am a suspicious type with this kind of thing. I'm always trying to look back and see what the motivations might be, why are we choosing these philosophies to talk about. And I find it fascinating that the guy that's because his philosophies are great, but I mean, I like the Omega Point philosophy, but him as an individual, however great some of his writing is and so on and so forth, was connected to a major hoax, which if hadn't been found out, would have changed the way that the world saw our very own identity as humans and our distant past. Yeah. That's how powerful hoax can be. It can change the world. And if the agenda is strong enough and it's backed up by a powerful enough organization, you can basically make history whatever that you want it to be.
And that's what happened through history. That we know that from history. That's what the rulers are always the one. The winners are the ones that rewrite the history. They're the ones that write the books to make it.
Even modern history, conquering weapons of mass destruction, goes on and on.
McCoy, what do you think about the rewriting of history and the controlling of information in the age of AI?
It's getting worse and harder to identify.
I get tricked by AI almost every fucking day on X in terms of watching a video and then realizing it's not real.
80% of media posts and we did a correlation analysis on with our platform Jira that runs continuously in the background looking at global events, and we discovered, because early on we were like, why are we seeing these identical patterns? Many of these stories from mainstream media to independent media, they're all being AI generated. And then we ran it through some AI generated identification filters to see what percentage of the text and copy was actually AI generated. More often than not, it was huge percentage, if not all.
Yeah, I remember you doing an X post about that, just highlighting how there was like 10 different media outlets that were recycling the exact same story, and it actually didn't have an origin in reality at all.
No, and that's, that actually coincides with what I've been doing, my own little personal project. I think I brought it up in a previous interview that you and I had where I was talking about predictive algorithms and kind of where they're going, but it's getting worse. And to kind of preface, a lot of us have experienced the phenomena of seeing an ad or seeing a post or getting an advertisement email on something that we either mentioned once in passage or even just thought about, not even searching, not even saying it out loud. And this isn't some cognitive dissonance. This is actually a very, very well designed predictive algorithm. It's not just one, it's many. And these algorithms are getting so good at what we would consider precognition. If it was biological, we would be like, this person's a psychic. But it's not. It's basic math, but done at scales and using so many data points that finding these hidden correlations becomes not just possible, but it happens on a daily basis. So like these systems are so good at inferring our latent intent from like tiny behavioral traces and from the patterns across hundreds of millions of people like us. By the time that we consciously like articulate a desire, the predictive algorithms have already been optimizing for them in the background. So, let's say John thinks of, I need to get new tires or something like that. Mm-hmm. He thinks about it, and then the next day he sees an ad in his email. Now, what is that, synchronicity? No, it's the algorithm identifying that maybe he was scrolling through his feed, he stopped on a certain post for 35% longer than another post, and he hasn't purchased tires in 18 months and he's traveled this distance. So all of these data points go into these algorithms, and they're becoming so good at predicting what we're thinking, what we need, what our desires are, that it's becoming terrifying. And then, the only direction for this is for it to improve. So the window of prediction will only get better, and the degree of success will only get better. So like these probabilistic identity links that these algorithms are doing only will get better. And then so we're looking at future systems that aren't in the people's control will be able to identify thought crimes or purchase patterns or, you know,
Minority Report.
It is Minority Report. It's the Great Hack. It's the Snowden 2016 documentary. It's the movie The Circle. This, we're being fed this technology, but people don't realize that how powerful it really is. The people who design and run it, they don't really understand how these systems operate. I mean, they know how they operate, but they don't know how they're calculating. The calculus is so ethereal, and the level of compute is so vast that it's already beyond us. So we're creating a psychic internet, a psychic intelligence that works on math, which I find fascinating.
But, you know, is it natural? Is it evolution? Is it part of the human story to unfold into something that's like semi-biosynthetic? And you know, are we a medium for something else? And that's perfectly natural. I still just don't know.
Well, here's one thing to jump in on that, and I'll take this back real quick. Sorry for jumping in, but this got me, and this was probably five or more years ago, was that Facebook at the time was experimenting with this, and based on some of the, you know, Meta at the time, and this is pre-Meta AI, Llama, all of that, at least publicly, that they were able to successfully tell when a woman was pregnant prior to she even knowing herself.
Yes.
Wow.
What the fuck?
Like, that's legit. I looked that article up, man. I got to look it up right now. But that's like 5 or 6 years ago, right? Yeah. That was then. Okay. So
how did it do it? Right. Just by
same thing as Kai saying.
Yeah. It's inferencing identity links.
Yeah.
Creating micro cohorts of people like you based on the decisions, actions, locations, everything you do is cataloged in to some degree, where you go, how long you spend there, what you look at, what you say, what you write. You know, all of these things are data points. To us, it's just static and noise. But with enough compute, you can find correlations, patterns, hidden themes in connections within these data to make predictions.
I think this one is a different one, but it says how Target figured out a teen girl was pregnant before her father did.
Yeah. What's the year on that, Jay?
This is 2012.
What?
Yeah. Every time you go shopping, you share intimate details about your consumption patterns with retailers.
Probably 1,000 times better.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, there we go.
I would go ahead.
You know, now these multinationals and agencies and governments have this capability at a very nuanced level to predict our behavior at scale. That, to me, which is why I started this investigation for myself, was like, where's this trend going? How much is it going to improve? And how might be utilized? None of the answers that I came up with are really great, unfortunately.
No. And then when you factor in like the classified quantum computing that's been connected to AI for at least 10, 15 years, if not more.
If you look at the simulation hypothesis, simulation theory, it talks about how, you know, it just continues on. Simulation under simulation under simulation. Are we base reality? Absolutely not. The chance that we're base reality is so insignificantly small, it's just impossible. But through thinking about the simulation theory, I've come up with a couple interesting things that I've yet to find any answers to. So in data science or in any sort of application, when you make a copy of anything, the copy always has a degree of degradation, whether it's, you know, 5% or, you know, 1% of 1,000,000% of degradation. However, in simulation theory, we're led to believe that there's an infinite amount of simulations stacked upon each other. But at any rate of degradation, at a near infinite level, you're going to run into some simulations completely breaking down. And that's just due to this fundamental principle of, you know, degradation from copying. And I can't see any way around it. I can't see that a simulation that we create will not be as well designed as a simulation above us, as a parent simulation above us. And so over time, that simulation will break down. My thought is, where are we on this ladder? Are we like breaking down? Are we toward the bottom, or are we toward the top, or are we in this middle demographic that is like trillions upon trillions? It's a fascinating theory, and being able to modify the simulation reality that we're in, it's not static.
Well, maybe there's no difference between are we at the bottom or the top. And it's like, you know, the whole understanding that I think Terence McKenna posited really well in terms of observing how physical entropy is present in reality. We are degrading. Everything is in some way burning slowly down into a cold, dead universe. But at the same time, within that universe, we see, at least on our planet, the propagation and expansion of novelty, human ingenuity, all of the things that make us an extreme difference maker in respects to our wider reality. We're expanding out into this reality with novelty. And so I think it's really weird that you have this dynamic of like connection and inventiveness and human genius at the same time as breaking down on a wider cosmic scale. So if it is in some way like a singularity, it's almost like there's no difference, right? Like the physical universe is going to break down, but that doesn't mean that the human consciousness is breaking down with it. It's in some ways evolving. Maybe we're going to bootstrap our way out of it with AI or something, who knows? But it's something that is almost being fought against by human consciousness itself. Or am I just really hitting this oil pipe?
No. I think you made a good point without realizing it, that the material physical universe that we exist in is very different than the conscious reality that we exist in. So we're a fluid, we change our reality every minute that we make a choice or don't make a choice. But the physical universe continues to remain on the same kind of fundamental principles. You know, gravity is this. The speed of light in a vacuum is this. Hydrogen elemental atom weighs this much. Like, those things don't change. Consciousness changes. That's what I think the simulation is. It has nothing to do with the material universe. It's consciousness.
It always comes back to consciousness.
Well, but here's the thing, though. But then you have verifiable stories of humans doing amazing things that aren't physically possible in the real world. Like, look at all the things that Pasalka was, going back to her, was getting into, was the levitation, right? You got these, was it Joseph Cappertino? I can't remember if that was one of them, or there's these other people that were saints that ended up being the levitating monks, right? There was hundreds of people witnessing these monks levitating, and you know, so there's some points that people were doing it not even on purpose. There's a couple nuns that would just wake up, they were floating, and all this other shit that's tied to, you know, right now it's tied to the Christian religion. But then, so is that a hack, or is that something messed up in the code where consciousness interferes with physical reality to the point where you can do things like walk on water?
It's a deeper integration,
right?
Yeah, the way you describe it as a hack, sure. We're basing on an assumption that those things
coexist
for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, if that did happen, look, consciousness is a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
We're not all the same level of aware. We don't have the same level of awareness. A dog is conscious, but at a lower level.
Right.
So to the notion that people like monks, nuns, people who have dedicated an entire existence to developing the muscle of consciousness likely have a better control, a higher level than most of us. So
no, I would argue,
does that allow them the God mode, you know, menu?
Maybe.
That's the thing, is like, I don't know if we have to like invoke again, like people roll their eyes and go, well, okay, so how is that even possible? That just sounds like magic. And I think we're beginning to approach a place where we're discovering biophysical markers in the body that actually seem to produce effects on the quantum level on very delicate substrates of energy. Like, you know, you look at the collagen matrix and the piezoelectric properties of the microtubules in neurons and all of these different elements that we're beginning to actually refine our technology enough to study and understand. And we're seeing that there is some form of an interface with fundamental reality that's taking place. The same thing that every hippie and every mystic has said about, you know, us being an antenna or a conduit. And it's just that, you know, I think is a lot of the time it's a language issue, right? It's just a how people describe it. Like, oh yeah, you know, people can do these things. And like, oh no, it's just if you believe enough, it's like people need to understand how that's anchored in reality. And what excites me is we seem to be approaching a time where we're actually discovering viable anchors into empirical scientific reality that can say, hey, look, these elements of the body seem to interface with quantum reality, and that involves consciousness. And that fascinates me. I think we're very close to discovering, you know, kind of like the evidence of how we're basically Jedi.
Tibetan monks, things that
John
talked about before.
We've talked about this a lot, yeah.
They can spend their time like pretty much naked in sub-zero conditions in meltless snow around them, you know.
I put that video up on X. Let me find it while you talk about it.
Or sit in the middle of a fire and not be burned, like a literal fire. Sit right in the middle of it.
Or generate so much heat that they create a fire around them. Mm-hmm. Like that monk video we were watching. I think that's fascinating. And, you know, when I was digging into all that, I mean, because in Tibet, and I mean, because Wim Hof obviously does this stuff.
Right.
But the original Tibetan practice is called Tummo, which is a breath technique to obviously change the way that your mind is perceiving the external conditions, and to warm your body up to a rate where you get into a state where you can combat against the actual temperature and the environment around yourself. But one of the theories when I was really getting stuck into that sort of research was that the original sighting of the Yeti were those guys. So when you had all of the early explorers heading up into the snowy wastelands from the west, and they were seeing these figures that looked quite hairy out in the snow, you know, like these guys were like ascetic monks who were doing tummo. And there was actually a photograph taken, I think, in like the 40s of one of them. And he was just big beard, long hair, covered in snow, yeah? Mm-hmm. But just there meditating. And like, so maybe that explains the Yeti, who knows?
Trying to find that snow video, but I couldn't find it. You know what I'm talking about. I posted it on X where he's sitting in the... You guys actually knew where it was because you commented saying you'd had a talk about it on your channel, John.
Yeah. He pops right out of the snow. It's like he's in, like, basically you're in a pile of snow. You can't see the guy. He's just completely covered in snow. And he's in this like little, you know, space where he's, you know, meditating. And then he just pops out. Just completely covered in snow, frozen, and the guy's just like,
"That's a Mount Kailash." It's a bit.
A bunch of stuff goes on in Mount Kailash. John Luke, tell me all about that.
Where they believe the legend is that's where Shiva lives under the mountain, ready to come out when he's ready. By the way, that's what might be happening in 2030. I read, you know.
Oh.
Inner Earth is going to open up.
Oh.
And well, it's about damn time.
Like
60 million. Agartan beings are going to ascend.
That's him.
That's his theosophy.
Is it guys ever read that book? Was it Edward Bulwer Lytton about the underground beings?
Yes.
Vril.
Yeah, that was the whole Vril thing, right?
Yeah, that started a war.
Well, I mean, that's where all this comes from, too. I mean, this prophecy, because obviously people talk about prophecy all the time, and but I think that's a fascinating one, this concept, because they call it the king of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea is that out there in the mountains, there's an underground world, another labyrinth, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's run by advanced civilization that have been waiting for the right time to come. And this guy, I think he was a Martinist cultist. He wrote a book talking about how they were going to come out in the year 2030. And I think he wrote that in the 1800s or 1900s, but that's a good prophecy for people to look into. And apparently the conditions would mean that when it opened up, these things apparently are like super beings, and they'd come out and there'd be, I think, 60 million of them.
Whoa.
So we can wait for that. That'd be exciting.
That's I love these kind of things, man. I love these stories.
It's kind of like Bledsoe's prophecy, right? Yeah, that thing, that gene change from the from spring to fall to maybe it'll change to 2030.
Yeah. I mean, apparently they didn't do the right interpretation the first time. You know how it goes.
Yeah, math. There's math.
I never believed a word.
Well, the thing is, and I want to say this on record for everyone who thinks that I like have a massive issue with Chris Bledsoe or what they're doing on like the contact front, and it's like that's not true at all. I do believe that he's probably had some form of orb experiences. I've had my own experiences. I don't think it's that difficult to actually achieve because I'm not some sort of guru, so I do think that he's probably had experiences, but we're all guilty of falling into our own bias, into our own cycle, and I personally think that he's been influenced a lot by the intelligence community, and people have seemed to just surround that family for years, and you don't really get out of that without being, you know, skewed a little bit with your perception of things, and, you know, I do worry about them a little bit, actually.
The Bledsoes are running to and it's not their fault about this either, but if you dig into that, they are descendants of the Bledsoes of England. Their ancestor left Britain in the 16th century to go to America, where they became the Bledsoes. But if you follow the speculative genealogy, they go back to Merovingian blood all the way through British royalty, and the Merovingian bloodline of France is the holy blood and the holy grail.
Here it is.
Wow. I didn't know they went that far back. I didn't know they had that background.
Of Mary Magdalene. What's that one?
The Merovingians.
That's that one. Yeah.
It bleeds into that. Like,
so do you think that they probably, I mean, like, do you feel like it's probably likely then that based on that bloodline history and lineage that invokes royalty and the, you know, holy bloodline could be a bit of an influence on the way that they're viewing the phenomenon?
Let's have a little think about some of the things they talk about and the people that are around them. We know that there's a focus on Templar archives at the Vatican, and we know that there are special songs that Chris Bledsoe enjoys to listen to. Most of them are by the band Led Zeppelin. Some of the members of Led Zeppelin were occultists, and they were very, very interested in first the teachings of Aleister Crowley. Jimmy Page, who ended up living in Crowley's old house, Boleskin House up in Loch Ness in Scotland.
Yep.
But he also was a collector of Grail tapestries. Mm-hmm. This all links to the Holy Grail, Arthurian legends as well. And
you know who else is the collector of Grail tapestries? Our other French friend. What's his
name? Him.
Yeah, it's his name.
Monsieur Jacques Vallée.
Monsieur Jacques Vallée is a big collector of Grail tapestry.
Well, there's a big intersection that is honestly only been pointed out to me by you two in regards to ufology and the chase for the Holy Grail, and these two ideological kind of things correlate very quite clearly.
I mean, I think that when you see, I think that honestly they want us to know that, but it's a quest that you have to go on to find it. And most of the time, awakenings in individuals are caused, especially ones that aren't asked for, are caused by signs and symbols given to you in certain patterns, kind of like, you know, I guess it's programming, but it leads you down certain paths. Mm-hmm. And what happens with that story is obviously if you start seeing a few of the dots, you follow the Bledsoe bloodline and you hit the Merovingians, or you hit people around that. And then where you get to with the Merovingians is that their bloodline isn't just the one of Mary Magdalene and Christ. It's one of some underwater creature.
I mean, there is a lot of cross-cultural veneration of fish god-type beings. I mean, you got, you know, obviously the ancient Babylonian-style gods, and then even the Dogon tribe with the whole fish god that came from, I think, was it Sirius, right? Like Sirius B or
Sirius B.
Something like that. Sirius B.
It's always Sirius.
fish gods, man. That'd be a wild one to turn up, though, wouldn't it? That'd be a good one to break the ice. Like, if it was fish gods in spaceships or something. It's like,
can you imagine all the people that eat sushi just flipping out?
The Japanese freaking the fuck out. They'd just be...
There are so many stories with the Sumerians. So there was a god, the fish god, that would come during the day and teach them agricultures and mathematics and astronomy, and then go back to the ocean at night and then come back. And that happened for a while, and then they bounced. Yeah, yeah. There's stories like that all over the place.
What does a fish know about using a plow?
That's a really good question.
Vera Reese, Hi-Fi movie. That was based on language and time distortion, and the aliens in that movie were squid-like.
Yeah, Arrival. Arrival.
Yeah. Yeah. The Abyss. Primo example.
That Michael Crichton. I read that book a long, long time ago. It was
Michael Crichton is a CIA asset, right?
He's dead.
I think so, don't it?
He was. Wasn't he? Somebody say he was on the CIA's payroll? They just fed him all that shit?
The Sphere, Jurassic Park, a bunch of them. I love those books. They were fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. But I think they're like, I mean, again, it is a matter of saying maybe this is how ancient people made sense of their own becoming. So instead of being able to say, you know, we've got a theory of evolution, they create legends because their fathers, who've passed stories on. And if you have stories that go far enough back at some point, they've one of had flippers.
Yeah. What's fascinating to me is the overlap that these stories have tangible roots in reality, but they shouldn't know that.
Right.
So that I find really interesting are the patterns from these mythos over time from all these cultures.
Maybe, well, isn't it like the Babylonians? Babylonians have a full kind of solar system mapped out, right? The Sumerians, they had that mapped out. Was it the Sumerians, Babylonians?
I think it was the Sumerians had all the planets identified.
Yeah, they did. Yep. Before we even knew Pluto was there.
Come on. You had the Dogons.
The Joyans.
They knew that there was multiple stars that weren't visible to the naked eye around the Sirius system.
Yeah.
Because they obviously were into the idea that these things were from Sirius. Sirius B, or I can't remember.
Yeah, the ancient South Americans, where the Inca, Aztec, Olmecs, they all had, they understood cycles in tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
So, like, either they were around that long, or they mysteriously inferred, you know, the patterns, the 3D calculus that would be required to understand how solar system moves around a galaxy, how that galaxy wobbles.
Right. It's like the amount of observational knowledge gathers over time invokes millennia, like deep antiquity. Like, you can't just like sporadically have that sort of calculation through a couple of generations. You need to have like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of generations of like worth of observation. So,
and the telling part about all that thing is, no, the, I'm sorry, but the big telling thing about all of that is they had that all worked out. Everybody, you know, we don't know, but I would assume everybody was saying, yeah, that's just the way it works. But then when you get into the Middle Ages, you have the church, basically, you know, Giordano Bruno just burning them at the stake for saying the same things that these people had known for thousands of years before him. He's not making up anything new. And then, but yet, if you put it through the lens of the dogma, all of a sudden you're a heretic and we need to burn you. Sorry, I just wanted to point that out.
No, it's true, man, it's true. But like, but you know, Pythagoras, you're talking about the idea that ancients were looking at the stars and were able to try and figure out how many planets are in the solar system. And, you know, Pythagoras obviously came up with the Musica Universalis, the music of the spheres.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw basically a cosmic harmony running through things. And start to map out patterns. And one interesting one is the dance of Venus, because apparently the way that Venus moves around creates a five-star star.
Mm-hmm.
Like a pentagram, which is why a lot of the time you'll see the pentagram attached to feminine centered goddess worship cults, especially esoteric mobile ones, like well, most of them. I mean, like Sirius, the Sirius, like in Egypt, Sirius was represented by a five-pointed star, the goddess Sothis or Sothet. And there you go, Junction Show is, or somebody
show. Those are my favorite cults, the goddess worshipping ones, because they always wear loose linens.
Hell yeah, brother. Hell yeah. They need to read that back.
So let's, you see what this is doing here. It's mapping out what looks like a flower, but it's actually, it's got 5 points. And that's where the connection to the female goddess and the five-pointed star comes from.
And like in that book I was trying to show you too, like all the cathedrals have that in the windows as well. For most of the cathedrals, they have
this. This is a cosmic and acoustic and spiritual and psychedelic like overlay that people are experiencing through various different mediums and observing again, like on cosmological scales. And that's what is really interesting to me about like the kind of like divine sacred geometry conversation. Did someone get hit by a drum?
It was me. My granddad, Aaron, my granddad used to work on this stuff, and this is how I kind of got introduced to like the music of the spheres when I was quite young. And I wrote something the other day about it, trying to understand this a little more from when we had conversations and obviously the stuff I know now. But I'll read it to you if you want. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
Okay, so the musica universalis, the grand harmony of the heavens. Well, the planets dance in perfect mathematical ratios like an eternal symphony. You can demonstrate this with an instrument called a monochord, a simple yet profound tool that ties right into this ancient wonder. It's essentially a single string stretched over a wooden board with a movable bridge underneath divided into different lengths. The great Pythagoras himself used one back in ancient Greece to uncover the secrets of the musical intervals. You pluck the string whole for one note, then halving it for an octave higher, and they reveal pure ratios like 2-1 and or 3-2 that make music enchanting. But it's more than just science, it's mystical. A gateway to understanding how those same harmonies echo through the universe and bind the stars, the soul, and the strum of a string in divine proportion. There you go. So
this is, sorry, go on.
Yeah, no. So the concept is that like the monochord, like if you look into what the monochord was, then people think that Pythagoras actually invented this thing and figured out basically how musical sound works. And then he could mimic that to the stars, the as above, so below kind of idea. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, man.
This is also why I think is echoed in Neolithic, Bronze Age, prehistoric architecture, subterranean carved out architecture that is exhibiting like acoustic engineering and done in a way that would seem to be for spiritual invocation and ritualistic forms of using acoustics to interact with the brain on a very fundamental state. And so, you know, like way before Pythagorean and anything like that. So it's like there are layers, again, coming back to cycles and layers. It feels like this knowledge was lost, forgotten, refound, you know, shared, forgotten again, destroyed, hidden. It's like, do you think that it's interesting that you have the exact same kind of echo of acoustic science in the deep, deep Neolithic prehistoric time where it's extremely mysterious? You know, these are meant to be basic hunter-gatherers, and yet they are accomplishing megalithic feats that also incorporate acoustic engineering. So just as you were saying with ancient Greece and like figuring out these very novel ways of understanding acoustics in relatively simplistic ways via that instrument, what was its name again?
Monochord.
Yeah.
One string.
It almost feels like in the modern age, like we assume that a lot of this stuff has to be done through some sort of extremely high-tech situation, whereas it seems like they were actually invoking quite advanced science through more simplistic ways of observing nature. You know, I think we're just too disconnected. So they were far more connected in ancient Greece, far more connected in what would seem like the prehistoric Neolithic era, where we were understanding the flow of nature, the flow of time, the flow of space in ways that we're only just beginning to understand again because we've become quite ignorant.
Mm. Yeah, they had whole schools devoted to practicing these techniques and methods every single day, every year, for decades, with multiple hundreds of people. And so, of course, they were able to figure out ways through experimentation. You don't necessarily need to know the underlying physics involved or explain it mathematically or get a peer-reviewed, you know, paper published or need funding. You just do it through raw experimentation and documenting. And this is why I think there were previous civilizations, and it doesn't prerequisite that they, you know, had computers and stuff. It just means that they studied alternative things that maybe equated them to early Bronze Age or something, but they had sophisticated tools and methods and knowledge how to manipulate stone, how to use vibration, how to use flow and energy, and could do things that we don't do today because we don't devote any effort.
Well, that's also the thing, is if you were a fully kind of holistic natural society, but you were going down an advanced civilization building route, you might be able to get to the natural holistic version of using a CERN hydron collider, and we wouldn't know the evidence for that because all we see is a complex stone matrix that's extremely impressive and large and multi-ton, and oh, it's got piezoelectric properties and it's orientated and aligned to this, that, and the other, and it's acoustically engineered, and that's very interesting, but it looks like it's probably just a ritualistic space. We wouldn't understand if that was how they were using, because one of the things I find fascinating about the planet that we're literally living on is it is in some way a technology. You know, it's got this dynamo powering it, it's electromagnetically productive, it's got all these different energetic materials composed within it. And so if you were a civilization that was fully naturally guiding yourself and you figured out ways to use the energetic materials of the planet and the connections to the kind of electromagnetic spectrum on a wider cosmic scale, different phases and alignments of planets and stars and how that might affect us on an actual real, not woo-woo, but real energetic level for the planet, maybe you could harness energies and formats and mediums that we would honestly understand and correlate with modern science, but we just do not see the evidence for it because it was done in a completely different avenue, completely different.
Yeah. And the idea as well of being able to control environments and societies through sound. I mean, like, you know, back then, obviously, like Mikhail was saying, this whole school setup where people practice this stuff, and you see that maybe reflected in Eastern religions where they all do the same chants, like up in the Buddhist monasteries and in the Indian faiths, where, you know, the very concept of Om,
right,
Om No Shiva, and, you know, like,
yeah,
different patterns that create power, and they create, and you get enough people doing it. You do it within yourself, and it can, you can transcend something else.
Right.
You do it with enough people, you can change a society.
Whereas over here, we've got like an entire generation glued to 5-6 second algorithmic dopamine spikes, and it's like that's a completely different set of consciousness that you're giving people.
You know, when the Catholic Church obviously started, you know, the Inquisitions and purging people of heretical faiths, they'd be taking out a lot of the people that maybe knew this kind of thing. So, yeah, that's, yeah, you look at some of the atrocities that were caused then when they were taking out these so-called heretics. There were probably people who understood maybe some of this. And what the Catholics appear to have done is kind of harness that energy for themselves. And that's where you see it in a cathedral. And then you do it at the cathedral, yeah. And obviously you get people get together in choirs now and they sing and people feel good for doing that, right? But it's a different kind of mechanism. There's not a control or an element of control using these frequencies.
Yeah, that's like a really common thing that I find it really interesting is the evidence, again, the evidence that you have in like deep antiquity for this acoustic science that was clearly passed around and developed and kind of advanced upon. And then essentially the shining exemplar of that is the medieval cathedrals, you know, these incredible geometric, cymatically engineered in the way that you've just got like these incredible geometric patterns that are actually reflected in the acoustics when you propagate sand on a cladney plate and produce the different acoustic geometric vibrations. You see the exact same ones in these cathedrals. And a lot of people would argue that this was actually a corrupting of the signal, so to speak, in terms of engineering these buildings, perhaps for compliancy. And yes, they look so beautiful. And then there'll be a group that would argue that that's not the case. They are Enlightenment temples, and they were the thing that brought us out of the Dark Ages, etc. So it's an interesting dynamic around like the engineering of structures acoustically, the knowledge of that, whether or not it was corrupted to, you know, produce mass compliancy.
Well, I think that like the control of the what was going on with the Catholic Church was so vast that it basically helped to form America. The Protestants.
Well, yes and no.
Jump in, bro.
All right. So yeah, I don't know if you guys saw my latest podcast with Scott Walter. I was pumping his book. You guys got a lot of that stuff in there, right? The Greatest Templar Tale Never Told. And there's growing evidence, and I think Scott has his hands on some, and I probably didn't say this. I'll say it anyway. He's really close to having actual physical evidence to prove that a lot of these journals were real, and that the story goes that the Sinclair family, along with the Weems family back in, I don't know, if you go all the way back to the teens or 1300s, started making a pilgrimage to America then. At one point, they started meeting with the indigenous tribes. The story goes, based on one of the journals, is that they were rolling up, and they came here basically for fishing, right? To check out the fishing and everything, and they got to America, and one of the heads of the tribe's son was basically drowning in the water and holding onto a log, and one of the Sinclair guys jumped in, saved him, swam him to shore, and his dad was there and was like, thanks. And that's how they became friends. And then after that, they realized that they actually had the same, after years, they had the same type of rituals, the same Masonic rituals that the Native Americans did. There's like a 3-degree initiation ceremony that Masons do. And there's also like a 3-degree ceremony that the Native Americans did, but in the Wadawin anyway, it's called a sweat lodge. They would go in there and they had more, probably more psychedelics, and they would get really, really hot. It was really hot and it was sweat, and they would have these visions, but they would go through 3 degrees and, it's become whatever. So they realized that they had like the same type of, like we talked about earlier, how does this happen? All of
yeah, life. Dude, we like to take drugs and hit up the sauna as well,
yeah. Right? Pretty much, right? It's that's what it is. They're like, "Wits, this is cool." So, yeah, dude. So the crazy thing is that they knew that at some point that they had to get out from the rule of nobility and everything else in Europe at the time, and especially the church. So they started squirreling away artifacts in America for hundreds of years. And basically what would happen is the head of the tribe and one of the Sinclairs or somebody in charge of it, they secretly called it the Covenant. What they would do is they would meet once a year or every 2 years or something here in America, the people from Europe and the Native Americans, and like the head of the tribe and his youngest son or his eldest son, I can't remember what it was, would be like, hey, take us to the thing. And basically they would go to this one place where only they knew of, and it was a giant cache of gold and gems and relics and some of the things that they talked about they found during excavation of Solomon's temple. So we're talking about potential things like the bones of Mary Magdalene or Jesus, or maybe the actual Holy Grail, or the whatever you want to come up with, right? All of these precious things, and they were storing them here outside of the purview of the Europeans. And the idea behind the whole entire thing was a free Templar state. So basically, where you can practice whatever you want. Everybody has a choice. Everybody has a vote. You can vote on things. Everybody's the same, matter of creed, religion, race, whatever. And basically that was the idea for America that started back then. That's kind of how that went. It sounds pretty,
where,
That's
where they, like,
no, the truth.
The Grand Canyon.
I hear a lot of,
I don't know about
stories, but with some,
well, there's like some like antiquated stories about the Smithsonian and other groups discovering Egyptian relics and areas that had hieroglyphics carved into them.
Was that ever investigated?
Well, that whole area that was apparently, I mean, this is kind of convenient, I guess, for the story, but the whole area that was apparently in has been cordoned off. It's one of those parts of the Grand Canyon that you don't have permission to enter.
There's a cage system throughout the thing.
Yeah. I looked into that. I looked into whether or not that's a thing, and I guess you guys may know this already, but it is a thing that there are large areas of the Grand Canyon that you cannot access, with legal permission because of active excavations or archaeological digs or unstable terrain or preservation of prehistoric and things like that, yada yada. Mm-hmm. So it's a good cover as well, right? It's a good cover for if they do have things down there that they want, but a single drone just flying over there could find some shit. So I mean, not that I encourage people to do that, but just saying, why not?
Sounds like a good use case for synthetic aperture radar.
Sure does.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, it does. Dizzy, right? Scan that canyon.
I'll or just beyond the light. Let's fucking do it with LIDAR, for God's sakes. We're doing it all over America, but we're talking about all over South America. Look at all the stuff that's popping up all over the place, Pim. It's amazing.
Everything's getting older.
Yeah, it is.
Each civilization gets older all the time.
I think our methods of detection will increase and get better, and it'll just become harder to hide a lot of this stuff.
I mean, it's impossible now. When they do the LiDAR scans and publish massive city complexes that would have to have tens and tens of thousands of people in regions that are dense jungle today, like, how do you...
With roads connecting them. Roads connecting...
Yeah, and everything's straight lines, and when you get there on foot, there's megalithic brickwork and, you know, tunnels, and it just is staggering how archaeology, it can just bury their hand, like ostriches. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, how do you explain that? Okay, these people had no wheels.
Just in the middle of the fucking jungle, in the middle of the Amazon. And, you know, it validates these early explorers who talked about things like, you know, I forgot the guy's name that went out there and made the big grandiose claims about discovering a civilization, and then they went back later and couldn't find them. And who, you know, the lost city of Zed, right? What was it? Is that Zed?
Yeah.
You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
And there's 100 of these. Give me, in a nutshell, why are and who is scared of that kind of information?
Ooh, it's a good question, Bern.
Well, I would start at the lowest common denominator, which would be at the academic, academia. But then there's also, you move up into the broader religious stuff, and then state-sponsorship narratives. So you have like a triple tiramisu of power that does not want narratives like this changed. Is that so significant?
So do you think that is basically, it kind of spoils a lot of our original creation myths, right? I mean, obviously these are different
lines. Well, it spoils the narrative that the South American region was, Neanderthal, or not Neanderthal, but like caveman, like, you know, there's just no way. No way. What's the word?
So strange that people are scared of this possibility. Like, I mean, even if I believed firmly in one sort of faith, this really wouldn't shake it. I mean, especially because a lot of this stuff is, I mean, what year is this supposed to be?
Kill that thing.
Sean, if they start pulling on this thread, where does that thread lead to? I think that's
and I think it's not necessarily theological pushback so much as academic, because they've already established their models from like the early 1800s and kept those going for so long that they're now being pushed back against. And, you know, so many people in the academic world in archaeology and history have concretized their titles and their accolades within these models. So now there's, you know, severe contradictions to them. You're just seeing a lot of typical human psychological bias and pushback and knee-jerk reactions. And I think some of it is well-deserved, because the alternative history is populated with absolute madness, just like ufology as well, right? Like, there's a lot of bullshit, a lot of like fakes and frauds. So it's very easy to attack that and go, well, look, it's just alternative, it's just this pseudo stuff, like blah, blah, blah. And I think they've got so used to doing that a lot of it comes down to just kind of almost a bit of programming, you know? It's essential in South America, by the way.
I think these discoveries lead to bigger implications than we know, but somebody knows. It's not an academia will say, well, we can't excavate all this. It's a budgetary thing. We can't bullshit. There's enough millionaires and billionaires out
there. Oh, for real.
Research.
I feel like Elon needs to get involved in this. This is the kind of alternative, spicy topic that he would get popularity for.
Get me in front of any billionaire and I could pitch this in a day.
Like, for real,
there's
right?
No, it's not a money thing. And
boys, give John Warner a call.
The fuck off.
It's not a donation, it's a fucking investment, John. Listen, it's a goddamn investment.
Well, that's the thing, is no one wants to be tied to it because of what it might lead to.
Mikhail, in your like, seriously, let's go there. Speculate for me. What could it be tied to? Tell me
the secrets.
In terms of what, like the implications, right?
Yeah.
I think it ties to the date of our interpretation of modern civilization. I think it would very easily tie to the younger Dryas civilization, which would flip everything. It would flip everything in terms of how we look at humanity in terms of cycles. And then people start asking, what happened to those people? Will that happen to us? It will. But these are the questions that cascade down. And I suspect that there are answers that the powers that be don't really want investigated.
Well, yeah, I mean, they'd rather build bunkers in New Zealand and Hawaii and begin the slow, gradual process of, like, kind of preparing themselves, right? Which just seems to be what is happening. So, I mean, it's more likely if you were an elite group with that knowledge and you were in the world that we're in, you'd keep that to yourself and protect yourself and your loved ones and the people that you care about. And, you know, the rest of us are just left to fend.
So the fear is then, based on what you guys are saying, is that it leads to a cataclysm. A social cataclysm. Like, so the Bible, now I've never been a Christian. I've read little bits and pieces of the Bible. I tried to read the Bible. So you go back to Genesis, and their version of this obviously is a flood, right? And then Genesis... Please do correct me if I'm wrong.
That's every religion as the flood myth, basically.
You're safe there.
Yeah.
So in Christianity, the idea is that there was the Nephilim, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a hybrid race of fallen angels raping or sleeping with human women, creating an offspring that were degraded. And barbaric, and they needed to be wiped out, right? Is that right?
Yeah, the giants. That was the Old Testament giants are different than the New Testament giants, but yeah, there was giants on the earth in those days.
They at least from the Book of Enoch descended upon Mount Hermon, which is in Lebanon and is about 30 miles away from Baalbek Quarry and the Temple of Jupiter, where you've got the 800 to 1,000 ton trilithon stones that have been lifted up above those foundation blocks at the Temple of Jupiter site. So it's kind of weird that you've got this correlation with essentially the largest stone blocks ever found, because in the quarry there's ones that are 1,500, 1,650, 1,800 ton limestone blocks, and 30 miles away is a fabled story of where these Nephilim descended down and began going about their business.
Genesis, right? So Genesis is a book. Starts off one of its passages is there were giants in the earth in those days, right?
That's right.
Great kings of men, the mighty men of renown.
Genesis 6.
So, yeah.
But then we get into the mindset that man was created by God, Adam and Eve, and they lived in the Garden of Eden, and they then sinned after Eve ate the apple, right? They then cast out of the Garden of Eden, but they're the only ones. Then their sons, Cain and Abel, fight over a sacrifice or an offering to God. And Cain's offering isn't up to scratch. So he then gets pissed off with his brother and he's jealous of him and he kills Abel. Then Cain is sent out of Eden and he's told, "You're now exiled. You walk alone."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "But if I don't want to walk alone, I'll be in danger." So then God, I guess, says, "I will mark you with the mark of Cain. And this mark will mean that you can't be touched." And it's like, okay, touched by who?
Mm-hmm.
So then Cain leaves marked and then starts to have children. And that's all in the Bible. So this is with apparently...
With who? Well, great question.
I think if you look into it, there was a race of people outside of the Bible story. Essentially, and they were bigger, they were stronger, they were city builders. Mm-hmm. Cain married one of them, and her name was, I think, Awen or something like that. They then had babies. boom, 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 there's your hybrid. Mm-hmm. So, and that's all there, man. Like, I mean, that you can find that pretty easily. For a long time in Christianity, it was very, very taboo to ask that question, who was Cain's wife? Mm-hmm. Christianity, if you ask Christians now, for a long time, if you said it, priests famously would say, that is a question you don't need to ask. And a lot of the time you'd be shut up for asking it.
Mm-hmm.
And now what they say is, oh, well, actually what happened is Adam and Eve actually had more daughters much later, earlier on. So then Cain just met one of them and he had babies with that, with his sister. Oh, okay. So to cancel out that story, you bring in, it's an incestuous relationship. Didn't even want to have your daughters.
Not, was there biblical crime? I'm not sure.
It's insanity, right? So then you kind of go, all right, so now we're at this point where Cain has had his offspring and these things are hybrids with whatever these creatures are. And I think that they were called like the Gibberim and the Rephaim. And there were tribes of some other kind of species. And I think this is what they're frightened of. This is the big taboo, is that there was plenty of people on that planet or species of humanoid creatures. Yeah.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the discoveries in the last century have shown that. We've discovered small subspecies of hominids, larger, you know, it's like the Lord of the Rings. I think people forget that the Bible in its earliest state was an aggregation of pre-existing mythos from all over the place. And they did that to unify their area of governance. And to do that, you know, let's create a new religion that borrows from Germanic, Sumerian, Egyptian, you know, blah, 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 Judaism. And then we'll create this new story that incorporates all of these. We'll change some stuff, take some creative liberties. And I think that's where we get confused, because we're trying to make sense of certain things in the Bible that have been altered from previous mythologies, which is also stunning because those earlier mythologies are unmodified. Those are the ones that tell stories that ring some truth. The floods, the, mm-hmm. you know, the Anunnaki, the, what was the other one? The large people in the Bible, the Nephilim.
Nephilim, yeah. Yeah.
Even, you know, Jesus's rebirth,
there you go.
The solstice, Easter, you know, all of these things are borrowed from earlier religions, earlier mythologies.
Well, you're right. I mean, and this just gets to the point that, like, you know, so obviously, like, the Roman Empire creates, you know, they see that Christianity is growing and it needs to be basically brought under control. So the Council of Nicaea and other councils before that, like, I think there's one called the Council of Ephesus or something like that, or maybe that was after, I can't remember. But they then decide which stories are going to be conglomerated into the new faith. Mm-hmm. And then they add some of the old pagan belief systems in, so it's to appease the pagans. But that appeasement takes probably a long time, a couple of generations, yeah, to kill out these wider belief systems. And that main belief system was goddess worship.
That's it.
So it was basically, I mean, there's artwork from the Renaissance of people being asked to choose. Who do you choose? Do you choose the goddess Artemis? Artemis of Ephesus, or do you choose Christ? And if you answered, I want to choose the goddess because that's our goddess, you were killed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Easy choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But obviously then it goes underground and certain people retain that knowledge. Secret societies, you know, and so on and so forth. Elements of the faith get syncretized into the Christian faith, which is why I think it was actually the Council of Ephesus a bit later on that argued about the name, the Queen of Heaven, mm-hmm. and Mary being the Queen of Heaven. They didn't like that at all. Yeah. Or the Queen of God or the Mother of God. That was it. Because it was like, well, how can God have a mother? Because it's God. You can't have the Mother of God. And they hated that terminology. But anyway, so I'm getting a bit off track, but so it's like a control system.
But it would have taken hundreds of years to stamp that out as a general belief.
It did take hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. That's why there's so many books in the Bible.
That's it.
I always think about the Aboriginals. I know some research has been done, but people don't realize they're the oldest, you know, non-changing society, civilization that we know of.
And yeah.
Up until the...
We murder them all. We just murder them all. Literally.
Yeah, we did. And but the ones that exist still pass on some of the stories that they've learned and throughout, you know, history. And none of them come to mind, but I remember reading some and being like, this is fascinating. Some of these have, you know, resonance with some of these other earlier Mesopotamian style of story and mythos.
Did you see those like copper sheets that were found inside of a native burial mound, like Native American burial mound?
Yeah, the copper sheets that they're mined in Michigan.
Another one.
Yeah.
Because, you've been diving into that little fan barrier, haven't you? Do you want to talk about that a little bit while I get this up?
Oh, man, that's a good one. So you guys know, I've been sending these in our Signal chat, but I came across this. It was like some YouTube channel that I've never watched, but the algorithm thought, hey, Makai, you'll like this. And it was right.
See, we talked about that earlier. It knows you.
Yeah. Yeah. So the earliest civilization to utilize copper in terms of like a societal wide infrastructure, tools for hunting, agriculture,
everybody's youth,
was not Middle Eastern. It was not Mesopotamian. It was not Germanic. It was Native American. And the date is it keeps going back, but I think some of the oldest were dated to 7,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
There were still like some copper tools peppered around Europe and the Middle East, but in terms of an entire society, this elusive Native American culture developed copper tools and like had a whole industry that no one knows anything about, and then they completely disappeared.
Yeah.
And then I've done plenty of research in my life just out of interest on ancient history, and I've never once came across this anywhere. And I'm like, why is that? Why is nobody doing tremendous deep dives into this? It's utterly fascinating. Where did they go? Every other culture that developed copper tools, it was always a precursor to advancement. It was always a precursor toward, you know, more sophistication. Yet the only culture that this didn't happen was this Native American culture, who was arguably way more sophisticated and the first. They just up and disappeared. So it's a fascinating mystery. It's something I've been kind of digging into, but there isn't much information on it. There's a museum in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Michigan. Is that right, John?
Yeah, I could connect it to a guy that I know from X who's done massive amounts of research on all of that.
I would love it.
Yeah, yeah. I'll hook you up with him. His name is Gregory Little, I think is his name, Gregory Little. He's been doing it for years. He's written a couple books about mounds, the mound builders in the United States of America. Some of them are out of print, and some of them are going for like thousands of dollars because they were so, you know, like limited prints. But he's writing a new one that's supposed to be soon, like an updated model of it. But circling back, why would To the Stars create a interoperability working contract with the Wapatinea tribe somewhere of up in, I think it's North Dakota and maybe even Canada, but basically their tribe, To the Stars came out with a press release in like 2021 saying that we're going to work with them. We're going to tell their stories. We're going to tell the stories of their creation stories. And basically the creation story was the white buffalo calf woman, the white lady. She comes down, and one of the things, she had the seven things, you know, the way of the pipe, the one of this, then all this. And basically The pipe is still, like, there's still a Native American elder that still has, like, these artifacts that this white woman who came, you know, basically down from the sky and taught them all these things. Sounds exactly like all of the white lady, the, you know, the white buffalo calf woman sounds just like the Bledsoe lady, like the Marian apparitions. Same, it's the same shit, but with the Native American culture. And yeah, that didn't end up happening, but they have a signed agreement. And I've reached out to the tribe and asked them, like, hey, can I talk to somebody about it? And I've got ghosted, but that's out there.
I would be curious if there are any, Jerry, you have a huge following. You must have some traditional Native Americans who watch and are familiar with their stories.
Yeah, definitely Prism and Alan X.
I wonder if there are any stories from their respective tribes that talk about an ancient tribe that used metal. I'm just curious that there's no information, that no one's ever talked about this. It's mind-blowing. This is a huge, huge chapter in the life of human civilization, yet we know nothing about it. It's just very interesting.
Yeah, we all need us together. We'll put our heads together over the next week. We should be able to get that figured out.
I've been falling down this rabbit hole. There really isn't much, John Luke. There's, you know, it's the same information that keeps getting repeated, and it's very minimal. That, like I said, there's a museum that holds thousands and thousands of the artifacts, but outside of that, there's really no broader research done.
I'm trying to find the bit on the Aboriginal. Like, I've got this from Tudor Stars Academy of Arts and Science, which is today Aboriginal First Nations and Native American. But, like, I'm trying to find, like, the actual bit. There's,
The one, the tribe? Let me find it. I'll pull it.
Yeah. Trying to find the bit.
I remember you talking about that.
So do I.
You actually still share this?
I still have shares, too.
Nice.
John Webb, just,
I think your spaceship is just around the corner.
It's just going to be around
the corner. After Lou's next book drops, which, by the way, I don't know if you've seen, he is putting a new book out for 2026, so that should be coming out. And then I think your spaceship arrives, like, maybe like a couple of weeks after that.
That's just right after. Yeah, yeah, that's gonna happen.
It was incredible what happened with Tudor Stars Academy. I mean, it was such an exciting, you know, kind of like catalyst jumping into the UFO subject, and it felt very confirmatory at the time because it was like right off the back of my own experiences, really, that all of these things were starting to occur and people were coming out. But in hindsight, you look back and it's just like, man, they were making a lot of big promises, and realistically, I don't know how they were ever gonna fulfill it. But it took a while to kind of realize that, because you were so supportive, or at least I was so supportive at the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I was interested, and I had, you know, the capital to, you know, in invest, but, you know, I never really thought much would come out of it. And I was right. Well, it actually failed more spectacularly than I had ever, you know.
But did it? I don't know.
I don't know if it failed for them.
We should retitle it Operation TTS.
There you go.
For sure, right? Like, it worked as what it was meant for, which was like a leapfrog into the public. And then from there, they've managed to just kind of like spread off into the various different domains. And Tom DeLonge's kind of been left to the wayside. I think he's just gone back to being in Blink 182 and Angels and Airwaves. I don't really see him tweeting and talking about the subject too much these days.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. They read you into like one line of some arbitrary program, and now you're stuck being able to talk about it. And that's, you know, that's par for the course. It happens to everybody.
Yeah.
It's good that people are realizing it, though. It's good that people are starting to actually realize it, and there's more of a consensus growing that actually, yeah, these guys haven't delivered a whole lot, and they aren't that trustworthy. Contradictionalism. But that's the thing, right? One thing that people definitely have been countering me with and saying is like, oh, well, they've helped reduce the stigma, and they've, like, you know, started a conversation, and we wouldn't be here without Lou. And it's like, okay, so a conversation has been started, correct? And there are ways in which I can sit someone down who's in my family who's not into this subject, and I can rattle off a few different names that have come up in the last few years, and it'll impress them, and they'll go, oh, okay, I'm paying attention. But what gives me like an issue is the narrative. Is the narrative correct? Like, they can make the idea of UFOs credible, but are they actually being sincere with the narrative they're presenting? And I would say no. So it doesn't really matter if a conversation has been facilitated into the mainstream that is destigmatizing the subject, if they're taking it down a route that is avoiding some of the most key strategic things we have to find out about the government's knowledge and the internal aerospace knowledge and all of that kind of stuff. So like, that's my issue with it. It's like, yeah, there has been a destigmatization, great, but it's been off of the back of a probably quite disingenuous narrative. So like, that's my issue.
Tell me, right, because I'm a little out of touch now with all those guys.
So am I, dude. I dropped off that radar and started going to fucking Peru and Egypt and stuff.
But what I mean is, like, so their narrative was outer space extraterrestrials, right? To start with, that these things are from outer space, from another planet. And
ultra, I think Lou early on says ultra.
Yeah, there was a pretty early on, like, multidimensional ultra terrestrial type of event to it. But, like, yeah.
I remember, yeah, there's different types of mankind or humankind or something like that.
Mankinds with an F. Yeah.
And how time changes and flows, and you have the cigarette burning, and, like, you know, all these different things he's used to kind of describe how they fall time. And
I was in love with all that when that first I was just like, this is awesome, yeah, this is so cool. And then it just turned into like a big bag of shit. But like, but it was like, it was kind of like, it was sad really, because when it did all fall apart, it was like, and I think we picked up on it pretty quick, like, quite early on.
Too early, because it wasn't popular at all to talk about it.
And then cocks shit. It was hard when you started spotting it. And I remember spotting, again, you know, it might be a form of mental illness, but I see symbols and patterns and things. And To the Stars, obviously the patterns in that were huge. I mean, the word To the Stars was it's Ad Astra, isn't it? So it's like a Latin kind of, you know, esoteric sort of saying, but it was a book by L. Ron Hubbard. The little asterisk, which is the symbol for TTSA, if you look at the logo, is a five-pointed star. We're back to Sirius, female goddess worship. One of the little companies in the background that other researchers tracked down to Tom DeLong as some sort of funding mechanism for To the Stars was called R2 Dogs. And I think when you look into astrology, I can't remember what it is, but it was something to do with Sirius, wasn't it? Star.
The Diana.
Wasn't Cerberus the dog with multiple heads?
Yeah.
Gateway to hell.
But Sirius being, I guess for me, it was like, you got this five-point star, which is their logo, but it's kind of shown as a, like a computer symbol, you know? And obviously two dogs, Sirius A and B, that's the two dogs, right? But the R2 Dogs was set up as a hot dog company, but never sold any hot dogs. There you go. You can see it on that one on the far, well, yeah, the two, the black and the white ones, far left, far right. You've got the little asterisk thing. 5-point star.
Yeah, it's very normal.
There's your spaceship, boys. They're ready.
To have financial mechanisms used by agencies. So really they're shell companies that do a task for an agency or a government, and they may not necessarily know much about what's going on, but it's just a way to legally launder money without having to get oversight. And that happens all the time, every day, for a million different reasons. So it doesn't surprise me that money was being funneled to TTSA through one of these intermediaries.
What I like, though, is the symbolism. Like, I mean, the fact that they chose names, this sort of symbol, they always fit, yeah. But like, and then obviously you had this focus of, back then, I remember when I was really keen on it too, and they were diving off Catalina Island, saying that there was underwater bases and stuff. And I think Lou went out there in a scuba suit and some that. But then again, my mind starts racing. And Catalina Island is the island apparently where L. Ron Hubbard wrote Dianetics. Now we've been talking about goddess worship. I mean, sorry,
I finally found it. Sorry, guys, it's taken me to that.
Oh, you got the white and the white buffalo
Yes, yes, yes. Let me just stare it in the chat. I don't even know how to do it yet. I don't know if keep going. I'm sorry.
And then Dianetics, obviously, when you actually hear about what L. Ron Hubbard privately was kind of into was goddess worship, Dianetics. He had a daughter called Diana. You know, ancient goddess worship, and also Hathor, which just comes up in everything anyway. And a lot of the other mythology around the UFO topic these days.
There it is in the chat.
But it all seems to come back down to the goddess. Now, other researchers over the last 20 odd years, 30, 40 years, have said that running through the alphabet agencies is a hidden cult that worships the goddess. Mm-hmm. And there's a classic book from the early 90s.
And is the goddess Hathor?
Mm-hmm.
She's got many names.
Many names, yeah. I don't think it matters. It's a syncretism. So,
Yeah.
Whatever the feminine source is, I mean, because you get into like a lot of these people, writers and so on, who have been affected by this. People like P.K. Dick, Philip K. Dick, right? So he wrote Valis, he wrote Blade Runner, all these sorts of books. But when you actually look into his experiences, he had an experience where he basically, for a long time, he thought that he was having signals beamed into his mind, that there was crazy Fourth Reich hidden Nazi networks operating and trying to poison the nation, all this stuff. But the overriding thing was that he believed that the world had been changed in Roman times when the Catholic Church was created and time had stopped. And everything that we know now as reality basically is kind of like a mirage. And he then, after he had this crazy experience where a woman knocked on his door and she was handing out Bible literature and she was wearing like the little fish necklace. And apparently the sunlight hit it, bounced into his eyes, and he suddenly had this gnosis, this awakening where he lost his fucking shit. Yeah, he went mad, man. You know, he thought he'd gone insane. But he started seeing Romans walking around him. It's like the Roman Empire was suddenly the reality. And California, where he lived, was just pasted on top of it. And then he started to have these messages from something that he thought was a control system, some sort of alien. But the further he went, it turned out that he believed it was essentially the Gnostic Sophia, the original female power of universe.
The goddess.
All of these people. Yeah, the goddess, yeah. It always seems to come back to the goddess. And, you know...
The Templars worship her too, and that was part of the hidden part. They called her the Black Madonna, and it kind of went in with the church. Yeah, it was the big deal where they thought they were just playing nice with the Vatican because the Vatican was the power structure at the time. Like, oh yeah, we love the Virgin Mary too. Yeah, she's great.
But the people that were worshiping her like throughout the last few hundred years and setting up organizations, they were more inclined to believe the Gnostic texts. Mm-hmm. So you'd see Gnostic churches being set up, which were then connected to Neo-Templar orders.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they would follow, firstly, John the Baptist, because that's connected to Templarism and so on and so
forth. Yeah.
But the other side of it was the Apostle John. Mm-hmm. And the Apostle John became the figurehead for this, or the venerated saint for the Johannite church. And that's where you start to see the Knights of Malta, the Knights of St. John, these offshoot groups, many of them connected to a lot of these people throughout the UFO narrative that have been connected to the same orders that are connected to St. John.
Well, was the one that you've put me onto early on, that Peter Lavender, I think Peter Lavender was involved in the Process Church of the Final Absolution or something?
No, he wasn't, man. I put that on Twitter once and he fucking flamed me. He got so mad at Lavender.
Don't blame me, dude. All right. So it was a part of the process. It was a mistake. I've hit the oil pipe a couple times. Mm-hmm. Just relax. It's all good.
I think that the connection that's interesting between the Process Church and modern ufology, when I say modern, the last 50 years, mm-hmm. is Whitley Strieber.
Strieber, yeah. He was an interesting character. He's a very interesting character. You have to say it right now. Do you want it? Yeah. I want to hear it.
All right.
Well, Whitley Strieber, like, I mean,
there's a really good writer, researcher called Jason Horsley, who wrote a book called UFO of Infinity or
Messengers of Deception. No, that's it.
No, that's Talay. Something of Infinity. But like he'd basically, you know, found all this documentation that Stryber had lived in London, like at the end of the swinging 60s or whatever, you know, like Austin Powers or something. And he was making little movies and doing bits and writing and, you know, cool 60s stuff. And he fell in or had knowledge of the Process Church, and he wasn't a part of it. I'm going to say that. I'm not going to see her and cast aspersions. But from what Jason Horsley was saying is that he had some sort of run-in with them, which ended up with him having some sort of, like, love affair with this woman who Jason Horsley kind of implies was, I think her name was Mary McLean, and she was the priestess, the main lady behind the Process Church. That was his speculation. And there were certain stories that Stryber wrote about him basically being put through. One of them was just called Pain, yeah? And it was about a guy who essentially was forcibly put into like a box and tortured almost, like it was kind of like
Skinner box
experience. Well, that Skinner box stuff comes up later. It's like he wrote elements of his life, because he's apparently, you reckon, his dad was part of the paperclip stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been involved in the bases where paperclip scientists were. And he had these memories coming back to him that he'd been put in these boxes. And then later on, he met this woman who he had an affair with. It turned out maybe to have been the lady who ran the Process Church. And guess what? Apparently, he looked in her bag, and in it was an alien grey suit. And he said it was super real. All this stuff's like being like hushed up. Like, you need to read the Horsley book. It's fascinating.
Well, I have to say that my kind of contention with Whitley came up when, I don't know who made me aware of it, it might have been one of you guys, that he had claimed to be witness to that massacre that took place on a school campus, right, in like the 70s, where that guy was up in a tower with a sniper rifle taking shots at people, and he claimed that he'd like written in his book that he was actually present at this massacre and had witnessed a kid get shot in the face, and then he wasn't there at all, and then he was like, oh, it was an implanted memory, and that's some wild shit.
Some wild shit.
Like, that got me.
He's a problematic narrator.
That was the most British way of saying he's full of shit. That was the most British. I love that problematic narrator.
Yeah, it is.
John and I would say he's full of shit.
Yeah,
full
of
shit. That's what I said. It's like the most British way of saying he's full of shit. That's hilarious.
I'm also kind of like adverse to coughing shit, especially on a flat white this one.
Don't worry.
I will say
the opposite.
Whitney Strieber's implant will flare up and come get you in your dreams.
Whitney Strieber. Right, here you go. Whitney Strieber, Communion. You're in the Communion book, yeah? Uh-huh. His main encounter. He says that the main alien was Ishtar.
Mm-hmm. Ishtar.
Yep.
Yeah, he pretty much says this thing was like, and it was like Ishtar, yeah? Looked like, it felt like it was a feminine presence, all this stuff. So all the stuff that came out in the movie, which becomes the thing that everybody else kind of, unless you've actually read the book, it's the Greys. This thing was Ishtar, the goddess. Yeah. And there was one particular statuette, I think, they said it looked like. When you zoom in on the face, he said it was like kind of the eyes that looked like that and this loving, yeah. And he said that she was the main one. She was the ringleader. But he said that, yeah, it was this loving kind of female presence that he was almost like drawn to it. The other interesting thing is when you just check out the dates of the abduction, it was the solstice or the equinox.
Of course.
So it was sort of and Stryber was very interested around that time in the esoteric and the occult.
Well, this goes back to the idea that there's myth makers and people that spin myth because of the ideology that they have, right? Like the Jesuits and other groups that are quite capable of spinning a yarn that is enticing to their ideology and to bring people in alignment with it. So, you know.
Oh, there's the other flip side. I mean, I agree with that, absolutely. Maybe Stryber, sadly, was abducted, but he was abducted in a
an occult ritual. Mm-hmm. And it was betrayed as, you know, we're getting some MyLab stuff.
Right, right, like the MyLab situation, exactly.
And again, Horsley was talking about the fact that he'd come across this woman who was connected to quite a serious occult groups who allegedly had an alien costume in her bag. So, like, you just got to follow patterns, and it starts to happen, starts to work. He then wrote a book called Majestic, which is about Roswell. And when you read Majestic, it's basically the Eleusinian mystery.
Man.
Right.
It goes fully into it, and it adds elements of there about Persephone, the goddess again, yeah? Little snippets of mythology that connects to her, rituals in caves, certain nectars that are given to the abductees, yeah? It's, again, it becomes abduction by maybe occultists as opposed to aliens, and the alien mythos is a cover story for that.
I think it's a cover story for a lot.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Multifaceted.
Yeah. I'm very interested in how occultism has survived the millennia in the upper echelons of power. Even today, we see it prevalent.
Because it's actionable as a method of getting what you want.
Yeah, there it is.
I mean, and if that's the case, which of these occult mythos is true, and what parts of them are accurate enough to warrant the recycling, the continuation? I mean, look at the whole P. Diddy stuff. Very occultism. I watched the documentary on Netflix recently.
Well, the one that 50 Cent put together with the found footage where he's you know,
50 Cent.
Yeah, 50 Cent's got no love for Diddy, and it hasn't had no love for Diddy.
He capitalized on the footage that existed, and he kind of was background orchestrating. It's really good if you haven't seen it. But there's one clip that I bet very few people thought about, but I did immediately. So when P. Diddy, Puff Daddy, Sean Combs, whatever the hell, asshole, when we were first coming up, he threw this concert at a school, auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And he put the invitation out, and it was him and some other big ticket rappers, knowing that thousands of people would attend. And I think, at that event, I think it was like 4 people died because of a stampede.
Right. Yeah.
And to me, I'm reasonably intelligent, but I suspect somebody at the intelligence level of Puff Daddy, who's incredibly manipulative, which, you know, stipulates that there's a level of intelligence there, that he knew that there would be chaos. And I wonder if that was the initial sacrifice, because there's footage of him seeing it, and the way he responds to it is so flat. Look, I worked in law enforcement. I worked in prisons. I worked around murderers, rapists. I'm very, very familiar with this personality type. And he hits every single one of them. And I'm wondering if that was his initiation. Look at who his mentors were.
Yeah, dude.
Just do a dive into that.
Yeah.
See, you know, where his behavior, how this was all born.
And this guy got given the key to New York. You know, he's driving down Main Street, New York, holding that plaque with the key on it, hanging out of the car door, going like, we made it, we did it, guys. Like, you know, this guy had power beyond power. He was a major player, of course he was gotten, you know, of course they got to him. Of course they...
Well, they've known for, look, man, they were watching him for decades.
Mm-hmm.
They know what was going on. So there was something that triggered, they wanted to get rid of him. Otherwise, they would have kept him there doing his own thing. Him when they needed information, or if they wanted something not legal conducted. So he was a tool, but he also was in this occult staff at the higher echelon. Well, and I really think that that early incident was the sacrifice that launched his career.
To answer your question, or at least like give some form of response to it, like before when you were saying like, well, what is the viable method and like, you know, the chosen path that actually produces this effect? It's like, I don't actually think there is one. It's about belief and consensus in an effect, because actually the difference is you are the deal breaker in this scenario. The human body, the bioelectric, quantum, coherent, entangled body, and the way that you perceive reality is absolutely paramount to how these things work. So because there are ancient methods that have been discovered a long time ago and refined over time and passed down from shaman to community to religion to church to secret society, these are the methods that have been used and refined and chosen. But I would say that it doesn't really matter what it is, as long as you have a form of belief in that actually beginning a process and you take steps to actually doing that. So I think that that's probably the best way that I would explain it, is that there isn't any like actual power in the process. It's just power in the belief in the process.
The consciousness hack.
Which is why they get together in like, you know, Bohemian Grove and do the cremation of care and all that kind of stuff. Is like, even if you don't really believe it, you start believing it. You know what I mean?
And then it makes it real.
Yeah, exactly.
Important is no one's ever asked me to be in a cult. You know, am I not smart enough? Or it's...
No, you're too smart. So you have to come by your own. You have to start your own. You're not a follower.
Very intelligent people are in those occult groups.
I think some very intelligent people.
Yes, they are. And I think you're right. I think they work. That's the scary part. I think they work, and I think that the methodology behind it's hidden, and the actual meaning behind a lot of it's hidden. So, because if you're doing something and it works, but we tell you that we're doing it, and then all of us are going to be rich because we're doing this, and this is a ritual we're doing to attain wealth. But is that really what's going on? Right.
Well, dark hack rather than the monk or nun.
Right.
Exactly that. And like, I don't want to get too dark with it, but there was that very interesting testimony. I've forgotten the name of the guy. He had kind of like an Eastern European accent. He's testified a few times. He's now dead, about being an international banker, financial guy. Like, you know who I'm talking about, right? You know, yeah, he told his story a number of times. I've posted it on X, where he, you know, speaks about having a very, very tough childhood, like extremely abusive childhood, going through foster care in like Catholic schools and lots of abuse there. And, you know, ended up in the financial world in his early 20s with a real bone to pick with humanity. So he was a very cutthroat guy, made a lot of money very quickly, climbed that, you know, financial business ladder very quickly, and ended up at a point where he was, you know, helping to execute massive amounts of fraud and like, you know, like destabilizing nations for, you know, huge global banking firms and stuff like that. At a certain point in this process of climbing up the ladder, he was invited to a child sacrifice. Mm. And like, honestly, the sincerity of his testimony and like, yeah, man, like I really think he was telling the truth. And like I said, he didn't, you know, survive much longer after that. But again, like the amount of filtering processes required to get to the point where you receive that invitation is in of itself a way of removing the people that would be shocked by it, apart from like, you know, a couple of individuals like himself. Most just filter right up into that, right? So it's kind of like it protects itself, because there's so many barriers and barricades of proving you're a fucking psychopath before you can reach the invitation to the sacrificial chamber at someone's island. But once you get to that point, you're locked in. And when he backed out of it, at least his, you know, testimony, when he backed out of it, his whole life got ruined, everything, the money went, all of his opportunities vanished, you know. So they removed everything that they'd built up for this man because he didn't take that final step. It's crazy testimony, man.
Do you know what? I mean, like, seriously, the power and stuff, it's not that good, surely.
Jeez. No, I don't think so. Mm-mm.
Why? I mean, what the fuck? Why would you even want to get anywhere near that? Like, you know,
it's always these people are very weak in character. They may be intelligent. They may come from paternal or maternal lines of power, or they may be in positions of power, but they're always weak. Mm-hmm. You can just feel it emanating off of them. Like, you look at Sean Combs and hear him talk and watch he's so weak. He's so insecure. And those are the type of people, I think, that try to take this shortcut through very dark channels. Instead of spending 30 years meditating mm-hmm. and elevating your consciousness to achieve what you desire, you take a shortcut.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like, you know, there are those opportunities through, you know, the benevolent sector, you could say, of, you know, go join a monkhood and sit and pray and be one with God. And, you know, your path will unfold that way. But if you want the cheat sheet to kind of getting that fast materialism, you want that Ferrari and stuff, well, there's a spiritual method to getting that. You're going to have to corrupt yourself pretty heavily. But there is a way to speed that process up. We've developed that method and we've got pretty good at it. We're running the whole world. So, you know, there is that other flip side to it. Like they're both present. They are both present. There's two, like these two different channels towards gaining things from this physical world. And, but also what's interesting, I think, is if you do pursue like a spiritual path, like lots of people who have become great speakers, who have gone out on stage and, like, you know, it changed lives for the better all over the world, have themselves become millionaires because of just the cause and effect of what they're doing. So it doesn't, like, you know, it's not like there's like a material ban if you're a spiritual person. It's like these things can be facilitators of your message, but it can easily corrupt you. And I think that there's an easy corruptibility within like the structure of power. It's just baked into the system itself. So it's kind of inescapable once you start climbing that particular spire. You know, you can become a successful person without selling your soul. But once you get into these power structures, it's kind of like you can't get past a certain point of it without letting that go, without like letting your morality just completely go.
Yes, it's about talk, man.
Yeah. Like, no, it's gone dark. Sorry. Like,
I do an exercise I've told you about, Jay. I think I told John, maybe not John Boo, but I do an exercise once a month, and maybe your viewers will find this easy enough for them to try. Once a month, I sit down, no stimulus, no music, no nothing. And I sit there quietly and I think about what I was doing in a month ago on the same day. And I also think about what the month ahead will look like and what I'm trying to accomplish. And it's getting easier and easier for me is to connect these three points in time. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding the more I practice this and the longer I've done it, the better my life has gotten. The direction I'm manifesting, the direction in which I want to go there in the infinite number of futures, there's a future where X, Y, and Z that I want to get to. To get there, I need to follow the right path, so to speak, in terms of a fractal branching. Mm-hmm. I want to get there, but I have to take a certain path. So this exercise, I don't know how or if it actually is, but it feels like it's taking me there. And it's something everybody can do. Try it, see if it works. If it doesn't work, then you lost.
I love it. I love that entire idea.
Well, I just made it up. I don't
know. I mean, the thing is, though, like, I mean, all these practices start with somebody making one up, right?
And see, also, that proves my point. This is what you've given power to, Makai, and it fucking works because you believe in it, and it does work. Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. Case in point, you know, you asked me what method's best. You found one. You already found one, dude. Like, that's how magic this stuff really is. It's the power of belief and perception.
Oh, manifesting destiny is completely doable. I think people write it off too much.
sorry, Mikhail, remember, I had a bad day and was like, that's bullshit, man. You gotta live in the present.
But I'm a very negative person by nature. I've always been that way. My disposition has always been cynical and skeptical. Mm-hmm. I've talked about a lot there.
True.
The difference between healthy skepticism and cynicism is profound. Skepticism is the ability to change your perspective based on information available. Cynicism is a default stance of negativity. Mm-hmm. And so I've always battled with cynicism. And up until my late 30s, I was like, I gotta change this. This is just not working for me. Because I'm seeing people succeed who may or may not be work as hard as I do or as intelligent as me or have the same foundations. And I'm like, there's something about me that is causing me to not get to where I want to go. And then I started thinking about that. And then that's how I came up with this exercise. And it's worked for me.
All right. Well, I'm going to start that tomorrow.
You got to battle your cynicism, man. It's hard because you create a center of truth. Your cynicism is your truth. It won't work for me. Life fucking sucks. Mm-hmm. I have a history of life, my life showing me that it always sucks.
Negative feedback loop, right? Realizing a feedback loop.
Yeah. And at some point you just have to be let go and take ownership of where you want to go from now.
It's difficult, isn't it? Like I get it. Like, you know, people are in obviously like varying situations of difficulty, but it always sounds like easy when you're saying it. But of course, when you're in a difficult situation, the most tempting thing is to wallow in it. The most tempting thing is to kind of engage in that part of the brain. It's addictive. It is addictive. And also because I think the idea of trying to visualize a positive outlook is energy consuming. It's exhaustive because you are actually having to fight against the tide of the physical thing that you're experiencing. But if you understand the power of perception, then you can begin to recognize how you got to do that. You got to fight against it. But my God, is that not hard as a human being, you know, on a day to day?
It's very hard. And how I started it was an even easier exercise where every time I had a negative thought, I would flag it in my mind. I created a filter that said, stop, that's a negative thought, stop it.
Wow, I'd be looking like the United Nations over here if I did that.
All those flags, bro.
No. Once you start catching them, you aren't even aware. It's natural coming into your mind and being processed as a natural
product. And those little negative thoughts will impact you physically on little micro levels. It'll tighten those muscles. It'll make you a little like stressed. Like it does impact us like that.
Oh yeah, cortisol levels.
Yeah, dude. Really, like I'm undoing knots in my back at the moment. Like I'm really trying to undo them. And I was actually looking at like, no, but seriously, I've carried a lot of back issues and like upper back and neck issues for a long time. Like it all cracks and clicks. And like, there's a lot of tension, right? Focused in a very specific part of my back for years. And I was watching, I saw a piece that Jesse Michaels had said, I think he was actually interviewing Chris Bledsoe at the time, but he brought up a book about healing your back through your thought processes. And it was all about the psychological connection between your thoughts and your back. And it's something my girlfriend's really like well versed in as well. She digs into all this stuff and she's been saying it to me for ages, like, you know, you need to look at the trauma that you might not be facing, like things in your memories and your past that are causing this kind of like tension. And I think there's a lot of truth to this. We carry like stress, like even if it's things like, you know, oh, I was like bullied in school, or like I lost a fight or something that made me feel bad. And like that's been carried from the age of 15 all the way through my like, you know, adult life. And
yeah,
you know,
a reality that no longer exists.
For real.
Still finding yourself to.
Yeah.
The past doesn't exist anymore, and we can use it as a tool to, you know, build out our future, or we can use it as an anchor to drag our asses back down to, you know, and have no control of our future. Well, I just got tired of it. I have too much pride, I think.
Well, that's it. Well, you've made the right decision because it works for you, right? So, I mean, if you're talking about a situation where you've consciously sat down and you said, I'm going to catch these bad thoughts as they arise, which sounds very much like mindfulness. Or
I do it on the third day of every month. I don't know. I pick the third because it's easy for me to remember.
Three is a magic number.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're sitting here saying it works for you, so I think that's a pretty good recommendation. I'm going to start tomorrow.
It starts with flagging your negative thoughts. So even before you do this exercise, you need to start identifying when those thoughts creep in and they're not your, you know, they're not your true mind. It's just a reaction, a cynical kind of repetition to every
stimuli in life.
But dude, there's a it completely reminds me of the Japanese have this thing where they don't get sick, and they've done some ridiculous research onto it, and they couldn't figure out, was your diet is this or whatever. And there's something within the Japanese culture that whenever a idea of sickness or enters the mind, that they're trained from really early to just completely push it out of their head and replace it with positive energy, like where they're like, oh my god, I think my throat's starting to hurt a little bit, right? And then like instantly they're like, nope, think of sunshine and rainbows and unicorns and whatever the fuck else you want to think of, but don't think about sickness. And they said that just positive thinking and flushing that out of their minds increases their virility, right, for ridiculous amounts.
I believe it, John. I do that with burns. I cook, right, cook all the time. I work with tools. I burn my fingertips, you know, not every day,
but right,
frequently throughout a year. And I've learned that if I do nothing, if I go, ah, shit, that hurt, and then continue on, like,
it didn't happen.
It goes away.
It does, yeah, man, 100%.
Get anything.
Right.
And
mind over mind.
I think there's something true about that. I'm not sending the signal to cause inflammation, to have a reaction, to continue the pain. It just goes away.
Right,
and
right.
I know my hands aren't like super callous. I'm not protected any more than
They're not completely dead.
Just a little of hamburger move, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think our minds are way more powerful in our reality than we understand.
And we are getting, you know, we're edging closer and closer through novel models and the frontiers of biophysics and science and quantum theory, then we might actually start to begin to decode these elements of the human body, the connection we have to fundamental reality. And one thing I wanted to quickly put up before we go, because it is getting, I think it's what, 2 hours 15, guys, we've been rock and rolling, this is awesome, thank you so much for chilling with me for this amount of time. I love it, absolutely love it. And Jean-Luc, we need to do a road trip, and there's a place that I wanted to go in North Yorkshire. Check this out. This is called the Devil's Arrows in North Yorkshire. These are prehistoric megalithic structures. Look at this shit, man. Wow. What the fuck is this? Like, this is crazy to me. Like, these have, like, they've been...
Look at that erosion. That would take thousands of years.
And also, like, exactly, Red.
It's Jacob and Boaz.
It is very interesting. And they are large. Look at the size of these things.
Was Jean-Luc is the only one who wasn't talking about.
It just looks.
I don't know how deep they go, and they don't know who built them. They don't know who bring them. Zell. They don't know how old they are, other than they're prehistoric. There's no known record of them.
Thousands of years.
They're huge. They're huge.
If we go to North Yorkshire, we can go over to the Ilkley swastika. You know about that?
Ooh. No, never heard of that.
Search it up, man.
You'll get smashed on YouTube for slapping shit like that up.
It's not Nazi stuff. I'm joking. Ancient pagan.
It's a bet.
How do you spell Ilkley?
I-L-K-L-E-Y. And then swastika.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, this one, right? It's not really a swat. Like it's a very early, kind of got a little tapering off on the side here.
It looks like semen.
That's
what I was thinking.
It does.
Does it?
Yeah.
Tilt your head like this.
You're going to do it like this. Yes, it looks like a cum stain. Yeah. When you sort of like, I mean, this is all over the internet nowadays, obviously. If you're in. The idea that the ancient swastika was the plow, Ursa Major following the pole star.
That's what it is.
Yeah, this is interesting, because isn't this meant to be like one of the first ever glyphs in the UK or something? It's like really ancient.
And it's just there in the floor.
We've got a lot. Like, you know, our weather might be terrible and people might joke about our food, but we have some really interesting Asian struggles, like, you know.
Hey, hey, it's raining all the time, and I'm hungry. Fuck it, let's go cover rock.
Raining and you will not fight. Yeah, like, no, but, like, we've got some ancient history that goes back, like, you know, before time was understood and history had been written. Like, it's, like, amazing, some of the ancient megalithic structures and old stone circles. We've got one pretty close by to us, don't we, that we're going to go check out. Was it the Seven Ladies or something like that?
Yeah, Seven Ladies, I think.
Seven Ladies, yeah. See, they're meant to be like seven druids that got fossilized in place or something like that.
Last time I went there, there was like loads of these kind of like hippie dudes like camping in the woods doing like...
Yeah, dude. Well, the last time I went up there, because it's the place that's pretty close by, right? It's like...
Yeah, yeah. What? Like, Matlock.
Matlock. Yeah. Yeah, like when I went up there, on a solstice, so they were like in abundance. It was nuts. Like, there was a guy with like a pair of bagpipes, and like it was very fun. There was a lot going on.
You want something crazy to happen when you guys go to these things? All right, I'm gonna tell you what to do. Are you ready? Okay, ready. Go out to your garden or your backyard or whatever the hell you call it, and something from your yard. Let's just stick a rock, a stone, a piece of something living or dead. You know, like a stick, a leaf or something, and take it with you. And when you get to these places, go to the eastmost part of where you're at, and have, like, do it serious, not fucking around, and lay the thing down in the ground, and, you know, either mentally or whatever, just say, hey, this is my offering, this is my gift to you, that I come in peace, and I'm here to, you know, have anything that you can show me or tell me while I'm here, and protect me and guide me to where I need to go. So tobacco is usually a good thing. Tobacco is a good thing for Native American wives, because that was always a gift, you know, tobacco.
Take a cigarette and just toss it on the floor. Yeah.
Some chew, to take your chew out. Here's the my zin.
My zin's not that made light and new respect.
Yes,
ma'am.
No, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not gonna hurt anything. What's it gonna hurt?
It's like in Peru, all of the various sacred sites we went to, you'd see these little offerings of coca leaves. Specifically, was the used kind of sacrament, mm-hmm. And they'd usually bind three together. Like, they'd get their best coca leaves and bind three of them together. I think touch it to their forehead and then place it down. That was like the way that they do it out in Peru.
So when you got there, you just picked one out of the thing and stuck it in your mouth.
Hey, man, finds it out.
Yeah.
Is it? Hey, what's going on with some of that big?
I don't just want the coca leaf. I want the holy sacrament, the powered one, right? So I took that shit and, like, I saw doorways. I found places.
You did?
Yeah.
You did.
You know, the coca leaf was cool, though. Like, it was just, it's kind of like a really good coffee type of stimulant. You don't really feel drugged up. Your mouth does go numb, though. Get like a weird numb mouth chewing them.
And these guys sound like all these coke heads in America. Like, I don't like cocaine. I just like the way it smells.
I like the way it smells.
Yeah. They munch them. They munch them by the bag full out there. Like, these guys have got a huge sack of this stuff every day. They just chew it. Like, you know, it's crazy. But it helps with the altitude. Like, with the altitude sickness, like, I swear to God, once I had a cup of coca tea and a chew on some of the leaves, my headache went away, like, within literally about a minute. Like a minute and a half, my headache was gone. Nausea started going away and all that. It works. It helps.
Well, I mean, you know, what is it?
It's sort of the Bible. Just tastes like a tree, but yeah.
Well, the Bible says that, you know, every antidote and the plants and I can't remember the quote. It's like all the plants and trees and herbs or something.
It's true. Look at the Amazon basin, you know, there's a vast spectrum of medicines available to us through the plant world, through the plant life, you know.
Engineered the soil.
Yeah, and that always fascinates me, dude. That always blows me away.
Now tell me that one. I don't know. What's
yeah, that? Terra Preta. Like, it's Terra Preta, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell them?
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I'll butcher it, but I'll give you something to start your search down.
Sure.
So they've discovered that in South America, there are certain pockets of soil that is impossible to have been created naturally. It's structurally engineered in terms of the components that go in it,
like the nutrients and like yeah. for the nutrients and everything in it.
Yes. Yep.
Huh.
And it took like sophisticated processing to create this soil.
Holy shit!
It involved like burning the soil, right? Like kind of creating an apt version.
They added potash and all sorts of things.
So they found this all throughout the Amazon basin.
Yep. one of the most fertile soils ever engineered, and they don't know who did it, where it came from, how they did it. It's fascinating.
Oh, look, the layering there.
Yeah, really, like amazing. It's such an incredibly clear, distinctive layering. Wow. Yeah. And this is something that Graham Hancock's talked a lot about, because it's, you know, this artificial terraforming of the Amazon basin and the idea that huge amounts of the Amazon have been purposefully engineered as gardens, that, you know, they were purposely selected.
Wow. We couldn't even do that shit right now. I mean, we threw a bunch of chemicals and things, but like,
they're trying to reverse engineer it to figure out how exactly they made it.
This goes back to like, this goes back to what I was saying about the idea of using the planet itself as a technology and a culture that was going down a very advanced route, but not the advanced route that we understand through wires and cables and batteries and generators. You know, this is the similar kind of idea as the opus cementitium, the Roman cement that was getting harder at the time, when you get cracks in it and the water enters and it calcifies and becomes like a crystalline structure, and it was like nanotechnology, right, eventually on this like crystalline scale. And like, you know, these are all relatively simplistic things using the natural world, using certain compounds and ingredients in certain levels, alchemy and chemistry on a really interesting like degree. And same with like, you know, the Terra Preta in the Amazon basin. But it's not necessary to involve high technology or, you know, advanced physics or anything like this, but it is extremely advanced. It's just like, it really does feel like a bifurcating evolutionary developmental path than the one that we've decided to go on now, which would kind of make sense, I guess, like if we're looking at it from a post-cataclysm perspective, if we really are post-cataclysm, like children, essentially, who have now been thrown into an environment of survival and competition. We've moved away from natural holistic connection to the earth. So it does make sense, but it just feels very clear to me that this is an advanced culture, very advanced, but in a different way, completely different.
Yeah. I mean, it's I don't know, man. When you look at all those, like Victor Schauberger and everybody that had these, you know, amazing discoveries for things that we still don't even use, and Tesla's another one. It's just basically like looking at nature for ways to, you know, nature holds the key, right? Like vortex water and things like that, and all those other things. It's like just mimicking what we see in nature and in plant and animal life to, you know, use that technology instead of, you know, wire, like you said, wires and semiconductors and everything. I think that's right. That will get you closer to the thing, right?
Yeah, Schauberger. Interestingly, King Charles,
the King of England,
right now.
Get your sword out. Get that fucking sword out.
The King of England, the current King of England. There it is.
Well, by the way, Americans, all British households are equipped with one of these when you purchase them.
They're usually in a smash-proof glass. Like, you shouldn't have taken that out unless there was an emergency. See, Dave's karma's going to give you a little spike.
My cheddar cheese. I chopped my cheddar cheese.
Chop like cathedral town cheddar with that, don't you?
That's right.
Yeah.
My pork pie is in.
Love it. Like a true Englishman. Yeah, sorry. Anyway, I've derailed you. Please continue.
Well, King Charles wrote a book.
He did not.
He did.
Yeah, he talked to somebody and they wrote it down.
To write a book. Okay. Yeah. All right, we're being semantic now.
Sorry,
the scribe wrote for him.
I've been writing a book for 4 fucking years and it's not easy. I know this damn well. He did not work.
I promise I've almost finished it, man. Stop busting my balls. I'll get it done for you soon.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you. Thank you.
He attributed his book, sorry, his name was on a book.
Oh, there we go. I like it.
Allegedly.
And in the book, he says the answer to our future's problems can be looked at in the work of Victor Schauberger.
Oh.
There you go. Interesting, right? And he said basically that sort of knowledge, looking at nature, and I think that was about water vortexes, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
For Tesla quoted Victor, mm-hmm. I think. I may be wrong here, but I kind of remember Tesla speaking on Victor's work.
Yeah. So Tesla made a non-mechanical siphon, or I'm messing this up. It's something you can put in line with water where the water goes through, but it doesn't come back. And yes, it's based on Schauberger's work where like it'll It's like a one-way valve, I think.
Yeah, it looks like...
Oh, Google it. No,
yeah. Yeah.
Jay, Google it.
What am I Googling?
Water would hit each other in little currents and
spiral
off each other. And then obviously
dynamics, which correlate a lot with electro
gravitics,
magnetic waves. I was gonna say gravitic, but I did.
It's a Tesla pump. Here it is,
Tesla pump.
Tesla pump. Yeah, look.
Charles is an interesting guy, right? I mean, I'm not a royalist at all, but like, you know,
it's a royalist is a thing.
Oh yeah, like people who are obsessed in this country with the royal family and like, you know, do all the celebrating and wear the flag, like do the flags and like, oh yeah, like have like your fucking parties and stuff. Sorry,
Tesla Valve.
It's a diminishing generational thing, to be honest. The new generations will give a single fuck about any of that, but you know, the old boomer.
Do you mean the parasites who siphon your taxes?
Exactly.
Hang on, hello, it's Sarah. I won't hear of this.
John, are you trying to pre-show?
I was going to. I can't. I don't know what the hell I did.
I don't know if I need to give you permission to do that.
Well, just type in Tesla Valve, dude. You'll see it right away.
Tesla Valve.
It's in my book. Buy my book.
He attributed something. I don't know if it was the valve or what.
It is.
And Victor's work has a
there
lot
it is,
of
right there
with
there it is. So it has no moving parts. It's just the way that it's designed that it'll pump. It's a valve. It's like it's a one-way valve that the water will only go one way. Yeah, it'll never backwash through it. But there's no moving parts. There's no mechanics involved in it. It's just the way that it was created, and that's a Schauberger thing. I don't know, man. There it is. Learn engineering.
I'm lucky young Jamie over here today with my fucking presenting.
Pull that up for
me. Hey,
I'm the even younger Jamie.
That's what I'm saying. Dude, that had to be so wild being on that. That'd be so fun.
It was, and I've noticed that I was talking very fast, and I think I didn't realize that I was nervous, but I must have been because I was like kind of like at that speed, like talking a bit more like that, like, oh yeah, well let me tell you about this thing about Baalbek and the fucking Templars. Like, dude, slow down.
We need to address the new tridactyl.
Oh, we do.
So this has been an emotional roller coaster for me. This
for real, me too.
Tridactyls. I first was a non-believer because I saw were the fake ones that they intentionally did, and then I saw Jesse's and Jay's work on it, and I was like, okay, there's really something here. And now I'm seeing some new studies that indicate that these digits were actually surgically removed. So I'm like, I don't know what to believe anymore.
Dude, like, I hear you on it. It feels, I don't know, like, there's a lot of selectivity. There's definitely, like, one thing that I had an issue with is that they were going back to the dolls, like, referencing these dolls, which was a very separate situation to these ones. And, like, I took an issue with that for sure. And there were, like, I put a video up today, actually, just demonstrating at least that there is still like a difference. It's like he said, she said, like, because these guys who have a medical background, the guys in Peru, like the Inca Institute, and you know, we're talking about like multinational Mexico, Americans involved, Russians have been involved as well, and you know, obviously Peruvian doctors and medical professionals involved. And let me find this video while I'm talking, but I just feel like there's like a lot of like kind of he said, she said type of stuff on this, because they're proclaiming that there is clear manipulation whilst the doctors are proclaiming that there isn't clear manipulation. Like, I got a video of Paloma, which I'll pull up right now.
I mean, how do you explain the thumb bone? Like, he's right. It wouldn't exist. There wouldn't be a socket there if there wasn't a need for it.
Zoli.
That's what confuses me.
Didn't he say as well that he'd met a group of guys that were making these things? That
I don't know.
Yeah, how could you even make it? Like,
well that's the thing that gets me as well, is like, you know, with all due respect to Peru, like it's not a very rich country, and the idea that they'd be able to, this is an incredible level of fabrication. I mean, you know, you're talking bone structure, capillaries, there's a level of anatomical micro to macro feature on these things that is so unbelievably impressive. That I said that to Joe, like, because we were talking about this, like, just in the DMs, because he's like, you know, what do you think about like these new videos and like skeptical studies that have come out? And I was like, honestly, like, it just feels like I want to interview the people. If this is a fake, I'd want to interview the people responsible for faking this, because this is such an incredible level of fabrication I don't really think is possible.
What about
it? It wasn't a fake. What if their thumbs were cut off and they had four fingers and they cut the thumbs off for some reason?
Yeah, like the head binding or whatever. Mm. Like along that thing. So
which specimen are they looking at with the thumbs?
I'd have to find the video I watched. And it was a very reputable...
Because I saw parts of the video, because it had been clipped. I've seen parts, but I don't know which specimen. Was it Paloma? Was it Montserrat? There's a few different large ones, like large tridactyls. Well, there's a couple of them. There's a couple of them, but... Yeah, like the whole thing's fucking crazy. And I said from the beginning as well, like in terms of like how they're being sourced, like, yeah, you're having to deal with like a really weird, sketchy situation with these like huaqueros that were basically kind of like, you know, working in alignment with the cartel and running on the black market, the antiquities trade in Peru. And they're the guys that are safeguarding.
That's a way for people to get rid of what's in your face, is you just throw out... You throw all of the inconsistencies at it instead of looking at the actual evidence. Lawyers do this all the time.
Yeah.
Well, this person is a criminal, blah, blah, blah. Therefore,
yeah, exactly. His story
can't be true, which is not, that's a logical fallacy. But what I'm interested in is not how, where they came from, how they got there. I'm interested in the actual research of them. Like, where's the DNA? Like, I want the DNA. We can do DNA.
Yeah.
I want the metallurgical analysis with spectrometry of the metal plates. Why don't we see those yet? Those are very easy with today's technology to acquire.
Yeah.
They just don't publish them.
No, we need like that. That's ultimately what we need, is just more study, more collaboration, more corroboration, further, like not undue skepticism and not blind faith and like, you know, ideological belief, but absolutely, like, we need to be able to have a more in detail understanding of them from a academic. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Systematically,
you know,
John Luke just shared it. I think that you found it.
Can I ask you? Well, no, I didn't. Could you show? There's a video that I just shared on the chat.
Oh,
and
in chat or in this chat?
Signal.
Okay. And it's that Georgiani. It's just a short clip taken from 2018. Just play that, because this has messed my head up a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can play it, but I don't know if I can play the audio unless I like turn my studio mic towards my laptop or something.
Mm. Oh, okay. All right.
I could try
and close captions on.
Is there closed captions on X?
Oh,
yeah, man. Like, Elon, come on, bro. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hang on. Let me try this real quick.
Yeah,
this
audio, it might work.
Yeah. If I turn the studio mic towards it, it should pick it up, right? So.
I pick up your input audio directly from your card.
Let's have a look. See if it does this.
Screen share.
The projects he was involved in, if it was.
Is that working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. One of these bizarre projects he was involved with was a genetics clinic, which allegedly was based in India, but had a branch in Newport Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposedly trying to clone material that had been extracted from tombs of prehistoric people,
mm-hmm,
in Peru and Egypt and other locations in the world. And the way Jonathan described this to me in the second meeting that we had together in London, not that first one in this, you know, palatial building. In the second meeting we had in London, he described this to me as an attempt to restore the genetics of a kind of pure strain of Cro-Magnon, who they believed were responsible for what we call Atlantis, some high civilization in remote antiquity. And he claimed that his group was involved with right-wing Hindus whose belief in the caste system and whose belief that these beings were like the devas of Hindu mythology was being used, I guess, to motivate them to work on this project and to allocate resources for this project. And it had a branch at a clinic in Newport Beach.
Now, that was...
It was not by anything.
Mm-hmm. So what is he saying is that Epstein had some type of ties into Peruvian mummy DNA and in trying to clone Cro-Mags into the human that he abducted?
Is that talking about Epstein? He's talking about somebody who claims to be from a group, I think, connected to something like what we might now know as the Priory of Sion.
That's right.
Woo. Right, well, we're getting deep, and we need to cut it soon. You know, we need to cut it soon, but my God, like, Priory of Sion is chapter two, maybe, in this one.
We're the fucking Priory of Sion. All of us are the Priory of Sion.
I'll be about that, man.
I didn't know it.
He's got a sword. You're in the cult now. He's got a sword. We just you're in.
We just need to knight you in the king's chamber. You'll be good to go. You'll be good to go.
The king.
Guys, it's been epic as always. Much love to you all. It's been really fun hanging out.